Welcome to Making Room, a podcast inspiring people to accelerate change by being a catalyst, honoring creativity, and acting with courage. We are making room for the greatest potential of our community.
Welcome back to Making Room. It is such a privilege today. We've got Brian Collier and Sherry Chisholm here. Sherry is with the executive director at Leading on Opportunity, and Brian with the Foundation for Carolinas. And Brian has been with the foundation for many years. He's led efforts with Project Lift. He is just a champion of opportunity, and this guy, just his story of social capital. He's meant a lot to me personally and so many in the community. I've gotten to know Sherry recently and so excited for her leadership here, a true change agent that has been a problem solver in urban school systems, issues addressing issues of race and opportunity and in her lived experience. So she had actually reached out and said, well, we'd love to talk more about social capital and opportunity. And I said, great, I know you want Brian to be here, but we'd love both of you to be here. And it just reminds us of, I think the two of you honor what we, the three of us, believe is that we really are each other. And there's the old African proverb, and if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And we're sitting here with two people, Brandon and Shivani, that have been catalysts for my growth in so many ways. And so I know I'm about to be a catalyst for Brian's growth, because I'm sitting here. If you're on audio and video, you can see I have some candy. And I brought this all the way back from Paris, and he promised me at least two pencils, so we may have to trade. So we're going to start and have a little fun. We'll start with you, since, all right, here's your gift.
So there's a social capital story in
there. Okay.
Anybody at the foundation knows, I came back and I said, I found the most amazing, they know I'm a fanatic about gummy bears. And so I said, in a team meeting, all staff meeting, I said, oh, I found the most amazing gummy bears. They're like, what are they? And I tried to tell them, you can buy them on Amazon, but they're super expensive. They're only available, really, in France. And as soon as I saw you were going, I was like, well, I kind of like John, but I really want these gummy bears.
I got a text every day, don't forget the gummy bears. I'm kidding.
Thank
Hope
you.
You're having fun. Did you get them yet? Yeah. And they were hard. Why don't we start there? We'll go, you know, we now know that gummy bears... Favorite candy, Sherry?
I know. I feel like mine have been stolen. I shared with Brian that gummy bears are among my favorite. They really are. Haribo in particular are the best.
Oh.
A backup changer would be the CVS brand, which you would think is not very good, but they're great.
That is.
And then I'd probably go to Fruit Snacks, the Mott's version that you can get from Costco that we keep in our home at all times.
Welch is much better.
Wow.
So specific. I love it.
Yeah.
Who's next? Let's get our crew here, too.
I'll go next. Yeah. My favorite has traditionally been the Reese's chocolate peanut butter cup, particularly the Halloween or Christmas tree edition.
Oh,
for some reason,
it's a
those taste
shape
better than me.
They add more peanut butter.
Yeah.
They taste better, but if you've noticed, a traditional Reese's cup comes with a little paper wrapper.
Yeah, exactly.
The pumpkins do not, and they melt.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point. My close second is anything Hershey related. I went to Hershey's, Pennsylvania when I was a kid and just loved it. I think I became obsessed and addicted to chocolate, and my parents had to take it away. But yeah.
So like a chocolate
lake. I'm a chocolate
up there?
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah.
Oh, are you? Yeah.
I love gummy bears, but I'm more of a chocolate.
More fruity candy.
Chocolate and peanut butter than the fruit roll-ups, fruit snacks.
What about you, doctor? By the way, all this in moderation.
That's right.
All
yes
in moderation.
So pediatrician answer would be that all in moderation, perhaps not have lots of candy in your house.
Moderation eating this whole bag in one sitting, if I can do that.
Yes.
We'll talk about that later. But yes, so, and then, you know, hard candy, choking hazards,
all the things.
Right. Be careful. Brush your teeth. All that stuff, right? Pediatrician hat off. Children go for Halloween, trick-or-treating, when the loot comes into our house. When I'm inspecting all the things, the Twix bars are the things that I find for myself, right? Something about the chocolate and the cookie combined together with the caramel is so good for me. And I'm also a chocolate fan more than a candy fan. Mm. However, if I had a second answer, when I was younger, we would do this Hindu festival every year. There's lots of dancing and there's offerings of food. And in that, when I would grow up, there was these strawberry candies. Mm. The wrapper looked like a red, like bright red strawberry with the polka dots and the green twisty at the top.
Yeah.
Every
but they
year.
Have, like, something in the middle
yeah.
of them?
Yeah. Right. And to this day, like, I had no idea where they came from. I wasn't sure if they came from India or they were brought here. I've never seen them ever again. Like, I remember them from childhood, but there is this fond memory of those candies and dancing and community and gathering together. And so that is a second.
Oh, my gosh.
A second.
That's up there.
And John, if you could find those candies, you get major bonus points.
That's good. All right. We're going to write it down. So I went all the way to France just to get Brian gummy bears.
That's
for this.
Happens, you know? On a riding course right. while you're looking for
them. Yeah, that's right. Well, I guess, you know, I was so not as I loved the Haribo gummy bears, mm-hmm. but gummy worms were like my jam.
Gummy worms,
worms, I feel like, is a game changer because you can go like full gummy or like half. And then, you know, something that my mom would never buy, there's like one of my friends who was like, you ever have the one friend who like their parents bought all the sugar stuff? This kid's, you know, cupboard was like Harris Teeter. Fruit by the foot. I mean, game changer. Because, you know, it's also a little bit like you don't get.
Can I revise my answer?
Fruit by the foot?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're like peeling
yeah,
it.
I remember.
But there's a little bit of like angst because it's like hard to get to, but you know.
You have to work for it.
You have to work for
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Worth it.
And dark chocolates up from a chocolate side. Like, that is.
Such an elevated palate thing. I'm like, bring on the milk chocolate.
Yeah, bring it on. I love that. Well, you know, I think it's important as we're doing, y'all are doing such amazing work in the community, and it's really galvanized people. And, you know, as I wanted to say, share with Brian earlier on a text, you know, just thank you both because you continue to step up, you know, and I think we're all really in this work. We're all trying to like plug in, listen, challenge our own assumptions and make things happen. So there's big roles that you have, but it's a reminder to us as we were coming in here, you know, Brian and I will text about pencils and journals is that, you know, we all are human beings and that there's humanity in this work of the people doing it and the interconnectivity of each other. And I'm just curious for the two of you, and Sherry, maybe we'll start with you, is a little more about your background growing up and maybe first just defining social capital and opportunity. You know, there's the love for you all to say, you know, what does it mean to you, you know, from kind of how it was defined in the task force report and a little, you know, there's background to that in 2014. A lot of people probably listening will be familiar, but Charlotte was, 50 out of 50, and the ability to move from the lowest economic bracket to the next one up. Now, those stats show that we're not far off from the other 49 cities, mm-hmm. but it was a real, you know, you all decided to act and create the report, and social capital being a big part of that. So I was just curious, like, what does that share some people who might not know at all, because those can sound like big words, and then how do you make it real? And who was that for you from your own life growing up?
Yeah, I think I actually will hand it to Brian really to give the definition of social capital. Okay. And then you can tell your story or wherever you want me to chime in,
sure.
I will. Yeah. I think it's important for you to.
So the story of the Opportunity Report and the story of my life are kind of intertwined because I've been in philanthropy. So I started my career as a trial attorney. Mm. My parents, neither one graduated from college, really didn't have lovely, wonderful people. But didn't really have a lot of capacity to kind of help me get where I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Orlando, Florida. I didn't want to stay in Florida. I always had visions of being in New York or DC. That was completely foreign to them. All those things. And along the way, I had these people who kept kind of identifying something in me when I was about to take maybe could have been a bad direction or just could have been like the least, the one with a lower trajectory for me over time. And they just kept saying, like, why are you here? What can we do to help you? Literally, people helped me along the way. Then I kept seeing my wife and I work for Paul Newman, building camps for chronically ill children. We built Victory Junction, which is up a little south of Greensboro with the Petty family and Paul Newman. And these kids would come to the program. Inevitably, they all had chronic illnesses, but they would be there for like a day crying. I want to go home. I want to get out of here. I don't like this place. And then like the next day, they'd start to fall in love with their counselor. And then by the end of the week, many of them didn't want to return home. because they suddenly had a relationship with someone. It was just, you would see this arc happen for so many of these kids. And so I kind of squirreled that away. And then I just kind of became a little cynical in general about philanthropy. You know, what is it doing? You see massive amounts of money. I had a chance to work with one of the largest foundations in the country on a project here, and it went south for a lot of reasons that were just, they just changed their focus area. And so when we started doing the task force work, when we started looking at the traditional stuff, affordable housing, mental health, childcare, college, and then I just kept trying to figure out, like, all right, back up and make it personal. Like, back up and figure out, like, why did my story turn out? Now, for the people on TV, you can tell I'm a white guy, so there's that. But I also tried to figure out, like, why did this happen to me? Like, why did I have a chance to earn more money than my parents, have a different trajectory than some other people that I knew? And it just kept coming back to this idea of the people who helped me along the way, literally made a call, not just told me I was a smart person. And so that's how we wrote that section. And for those who don't know what we're talking about, you can get really wonky in the definition, but the way that we defined it was the way that J.D. Vance did in Hillbilly Elegy, which was the networks and relationships that exist in our life have economic value. Mm. So specifically, I'm not talking about a friendship where you just get to know somebody and maybe a different race or something like that. What I'm talking about are relationships that have economic value to one another. They connect you to resources, they connect you to jobs, they connect you to the values and the way that another system might work. You know, someone from a certain community might not know the way a business community, the language they use, the attire. We were joking coming in here about our yeah. dress. All of those things can make you feel like a foreigner in those areas. So that's the very long way of answering it.
Yeah.
It's the networks that exist in your life that provide this value to you. And I would just say this, the reason why it doesn't exist in a lot of reports is because the people who have had social capital in their life tend to discount it when they're talking about program responses, because they tend to say you can't measure it. You know, all of these things that are, to me, mere excuses for, or in some cases, just denials of how they got to where they are. I mean, everybody got to where they are because somebody helped them, even if it's your parents. I can't tell you how many people we talked to when we were doing the task force work that if you asked them how they got out of poverty, they didn't tell you a program. No offense, wasn't the why or anything. It was the person at the why, or it was the person in their neighborhood.
Yeah. So. Wow.
That's great.
Yeah. Sherry, responses.
Yeah. So I've heard Brian's story before, but it's good to hear it again. Because in defining social capital, I think that it's something that has touched all of us. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I forget those points at which, the transition points, because there are small instances where you've had relationships with folks that sometime have been long and lasting. And sometimes it's for a point in time, but completely change your life in ways you wouldn't expect. My story in thinking about social capital is I am a native Detroiter. Born and raised just outside, or born in Detroit. We moved out later in life. And my grandparents are the result of the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. So my grandparents are from the rural South in Alabama and Georgia. And so they came to Detroit to work in the auto industry when Ford was really building the auto industry. So it was in hope of better economic opportunity, or really the middle class, like, to make it very plain. They wanted to live a middle class life and didn't see that for themselves. And so came to Detroit to do that. And in a lot of ways, we're able to achieve that. I tell, folks, my grandparents worked on the line. My grandmother was a teacher's aide. My mom became a teacher, principal. And I've spent most of my career leading large urban school districts. Mm-hmm. So generation after generation, they were able to have that economic mobility. And a lot of it, people would attribute to, gone to really great undergraduate and graduate schools. And that's, of course, part of it. But it was more the people who rallied around me to get there. And as you were talking, Brian, I was thinking about my story and like, who would I lift up? Because honestly, there've been a lot. Like, if we're honest with ourselves, there've been a lot of people. For me, the first person that comes to mind is this little girl named Melissa who lived down the street from me. And my family was not very involved in church, but she was, and she invited me to Vacation Bible School. Joining this church opened a whole new world for me. Many people know, like, around the Black churches where everyone comes together of lots of different means. And so we were doing well, but there were people there who worked as executives at Ford or at GM, and they had, you know, they went to nicer restaurants, or both parents had gone to college. And as a result of that, they introduced me to a world that I wasn't a part of. So my mom was a professional, but, you know, nurses, police officers, teachers are often seen as like gateway careers. So it's the first step out of poverty, whereas folks who are executives, probably more generational. And so I was able to learn about professions or a way of life that I had never considered before. And it was because Melissa invited me and introduced me to all these other folks. And so that was when I really began to think differently about what my life could look like, and knew that it would be much like Brian leaving Detroit. Like, I knew at a very young age that I wanted something more. And then probably the next person that I would think about would be not my network, but my mom. So my mom was an elementary school teacher until she became principal. And one year she decided that she was going to work at like the new charter school. And as y'all know, you know, charter schools usually attract new people, they're building their staff, and she so happened to be the only Black teacher in this charter school that brought in teachers from all over who are all white. One of the other teachers was enrolling her daughter in a summer program where they got to go to Norway for the summer on an exchange program. And so my mom comes to me and she's like, this teacher said you might be interested in it. Like, here's the video that we put like in the VHS that you could look at. And I was like, yes. I want to do it. So at 11 years old, I went to Norway, only little Black girl with a bunch of other, you know, students of higher means who are white, and went to Scandinavia to see how they lived on a peppermint farm where the mom was an engineer and the dad was a stay-at-home dad. I had never seen anything like that before. Like, I'd never seen people live on a farm. I didn't know that a mom could work and a dad could stay at home. There's these things that, you know, of course it introduced me to a new world and culture of being generally, but just in terms of like, oh, my life could look like this in a way that I never thought about before. So again, another transition point where then I was like, well, I thought I wanted to leave Michigan. I want to leave the country and see what's possible. And then the last story I'll tell is I went to University of Michigan undergrad. Go Blue.
We got a med school alum here too.
How you have to claim a major. Mm-hmm. And so I did a very small program called Organizational Studies, and it was about folks who like wanted to do business but also like really cared about people and didn't understand how to bring them together. Generally, it's org psych, but it was like more of a econ business, blah, blah, blah. And so I didn't know what I was doing next, right? Like, I had this degree. I was really passionate about nonprofit. And I also knew I had to pay off a bunch of student loans. So I was like trying to figure that out. And Mary Claire, who was from Boston and had gone to Andover and, you know, just came from like different means, was like, well, I'm applying to be a consultant. And I was like, I don't even know what that is. But she was like, you can case study with me. And I was like, okay. I literally didn't know what she was talking about. She was like, you can just help me practice. Like, you'll ask me some questions and I'll answer and then you'll give me feedback. And so we were doing it and she was like, I think you should apply. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't really think I'm smart enough. And she was like, no, you should do it. Just like come with me to the career fair. Mm. And so Mary Claire invited me to the career fair. My first job was with Deloitte Consulting. I literally didn't know what a consultant was when I applied for the job. But I could case study. And Mary Claire introduced me because it was a part of her world. Like, people that she grew up were consultants. Being a consultant as my first job has opened so many doors and continues to open doors for me now, 15 years later. And so those are, like, instances where it wasn't like I joined a program or I did this, but there were people who saw something in me, whether it had been friendship or potential, that opened opportunities for what would be possible for my life. And so when I think about the task force and social capital, of course we want to manufacture ways to do that, but I think it's even more important for people to think about, as an individual, who are you touching and what could that look like? And it's not as heavy a lift as you think in terms of opening your world to those who are around you.
That's great. I like that. I was just going to ask you, because as I was thinking about both of you were talking, these moments of social capital, they're always like, you know, haphazard or spontaneous. They're never like, I forced went to this program and then I made this connection and a network. It's kind of like, this person just randomly popped into my life and they opened these doors. And so the balance between forcing it and manufacturing, say we got to create social capital as opposed to, I don't know what the other option is, but creating more of the opportunities for these spontaneous connections to happen. Just how you both think about that, I'd be curious.
Yeah.
So some research that we did last year with Brookings was around how networks get created. And I think one of the first things that people, well, one of the first things that people need to recognize is the admission that you got somewhere because somebody helped you.
That's right.
So that's the first one. Yep. Because then you're more open to saying, all right, how am I going to pass it on?
Right.
How am I going to, you know, and how did I get, how did I build that network?
Point.
So that's one. The other is that there are, there's social capital that exists within a group, and then there's the bridging social capital that extends. So if someone says, I'm going to build social capital, but it's only within a white group or an affluent group, like if her friend Mary Claire had not extended to Sherry, but had just done, you know, made a call to another Andover person, then that's no good. I mean, good for somebody, but it's not good in terms of societal benefit and economic mobility. And so I think the first is to recognize that, to be intentional. One of the things that, so I had the chance to work for Paul Newman, and one of the things that I loved about working for him was always in the, whenever he was talking about charity, he was talking about his life in terms of luck. Good luck versus bad luck. And he would tell you, like, everything, who I am, much of it is because of luck. You know, being born healthy, do all of these things. And so one of the things that when I had a chance to talk to him about it, though, is luck is luck, can't be predicted, but you can increase the chances of good luck occurring to you in certain ways. And I would say the same thing about social capital. If you are intentional about how you reach out to people, the organizations that you're a part of, who you talk to it, and who you invite to be at your meetings or at your dinners. I cannot tell you, and your children, you know, those with children, I can't tell you how many people during our conversations, as I mentioned, who would cite things like, I went to someone's house who was more affluent than we were, and they talked about a vacation. I'd never heard of, like, you know, going to or a beach house.
Right.
Or just having a conversation around the table about the day's events. And for some, that was not the way that they had dinner.
That's right.
And so I think people just need to realize you never know when that little spark is going to happen. And so the more you do it, the more intentional you are. And there, Sherry and I will probably talk about some ways that we think that there you can be you can be in, you know, you can help maybe foster an environment like that. But I would just say intentionality is the key to it.
Yeah, that's great.
Do you feel like that is something that then is taught to societies or created? Like, how do we foster that in people who have the potential to be social capital providers?
Yeah, so one of the things that we, and I keep saying, oh, we put this in the report, in the report. We really tried to do a brain dump of a lot of things. Again, what we were trying to get, there's an academic section of the report where we said, you know, increase affordable housing by X, increase the access to childcare by Y. But then the social capital section was really trying to talk to people about, let's put the BS over here. Let's put the programmatic responses over here.
Right.
And let's just talk about reality. And one of the things that we talked about was, you know, a number of the kids that we talked to, they were okay with people making more money than someone else because they aspired to that. What they did not know was that they were okay with this idea of the playing field not being level. What they did not realize is that there are separate playing fields that they had no knowledge about. And so one of the things that we put into the report that I really want to build off of is I think the way that you build social capital, in addition to just being more intentional on the individual level, is how could we back up as a community and talk about the values that we aspire to? Because when we were doing this work, I read this book called The Nordic Theory of Everything. And what the author says, she's comparing Finland to the U.S. and the pluses and minuses, and dispelling myths about, oh, the Scandinavian countries tax you. Well, if you actually look at what you get for those taxes, there might be a trade-off that's neutral in terms of cost. But there was a statement in there that just like it just hit me, was something to the effect of that the U.S. is alone amongst developed countries in creating a system that is so fragile, a safety net that is so thin, that we are forced to compromise our values and beliefs in order for our own protection, the protection of our child. Mm-hmm. We would trade off what we believe in for mm-hmm. ensuring safety. Because we're scared. Everybody, I mean, affluent people are scared to death. You're one big hospital bill. Your parents are aging. Your kid, you know, all this stuff's going on. So I think we have to back up and start to ask ourselves, like, how do we get into this situation? How do we get ourselves out of it? How do we treat each other with love, kindness, and respect? And I think a lot of things flow from that. Affordable housing flows from that. Mental health, elder care flows from it, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have a question for you, and I know we're going to get to. I don't want to lose it, so I'm going to pin it for John about the abundance question because I do think you're absolutely right. A lot of people are scared, and they fear even for. So one of the articles in New York Times is the African American male that said, even if I obtain a higher social status ranking or I somehow reach into the higher rung, that doesn't mean anything with respect to my kids,
right.
And it doesn't change their likelihood, whereas it's not the case for my counterparts who are not African-American. So even that's scary, mm-hmm. right? So I do think just coming from this place of abundance that we're not in this against each other like Hunger Games or Squid Games. We're kind of in this together. There's enough for everybody. So I don't want to lose track of that. Sorry, I went on a tangent there.
That New York Times article, which is one of the best graphics you will ever look at, says that essentially a high-income black boy has the same chances of falling into the bottom three quintiles of income as a white boy has of moving to the top two.
Yeah.
So in other words, and by the way, almost no white boy born into affluence drops.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's sticky.
Yep.
But... let that resonate. One thing the other thing that strikes me about social capital, which is tricky, right? And I think it goes back to level playing fields and just how this system is designed, is that just like any other capital, when you give a lot of money to someone, they may not know how to receive it and manage it. A lot of times I find this, or I wouldn't say a lot of times, but I've seen it happen where we create these opportunities for social capital to be shared, and someone steps out, I'm going to try this out, and the person isn't able to receive it, or they never experience. They don't know what they're supposed to do with this, or how they're supposed to follow up. And then that gives the person an excuse. Well, I tried, and look, they didn't follow up with me. They didn't. But it's just a disconnect where they haven't been given the tools, kind of like financial literacy, right. Social capital literacy of this is what you do when someone with these resources reaches out to you.
Agreed. Before coming to Charlotte for Leading on Opportunity, I led an organization that focused on youth workforce development. So it was providing students, high school students, with paid internships during the entirety of their senior year. And then that was supposed to help them figure out what the next step would be. And we provided wraparound case management supports. We were bringing students who were from Detroit to the business center who'd never been there before.
Right.
And so we provided them with this job, but they've never been in a business setting. They don't understand or know anything about business culture. And then we moved to Zoom. And so what is Zoom culture, right? And so the students would come on, but their face wouldn't be there, or like maybe their hair was wrapped up, or maybe their little brother was there. And they were trying to do life. But our, corporate partners were like, well, they're not, showing up professionally. They have no idea what this looks like. And they want to be there for the opportunity. And yet no one has described to them what it looks like to participate in this system. And so, we were talking earlier about what is it like when you, at least I like to think about it, honestly, sometimes when talking to my husband, let me come to your country, right? When you go to another country, you go and you experience that place. And sometimes when I'm, having conversations with him because we're so different, it's like, well, how do I step into how you might be understanding this? And then, then change my response as a result. And so I think that is required when folks who are coming from the majority or the norm, when they're seeking to interact with folks who are different from them, the assumption is that those people will know how to engage in your space. And I would encourage folks to think about, well, are you entering their space to understand what they might be bringing to the table?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be their culture, their trauma, their conditions from that day, all of us inform how we come to a room. Mm-hmm. And so there's also that when you are seeking to do good, that there is some change required of you as well. That's what I think of.
I really think that is so important, because we were talking about that just, you know, and Brian, you said kind of like taking like two or three steps back to like what could really create this change. Mm-hmm. And that coming in with something as simple as curiosity, mm-hmm, you know, and I think that's why I love the, you know, Isabel Wilkerson's book on caste, because I think what sometimes we don't see when the focus is just related to ethnicity is that we're also not seeing is that, you know, we're in a system that's based on hierarchy, and I need more than you, so I've got to, you know, and that's what I think she said in the book, that, you know, the bones of our issue is caste, mm-hmm, and hierarchy. The skin is race, and so until we really understand that, and I will say for me, it does take a shift, because, you know, being a white male and raised to, as an athlete, to just go, and you work harder, is that not seeing the certain advantages that I had, and then to also think, because if I was successful quick, that means I have all the answers. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that, you know, in college, mm-hmm, I almost dropped out my freshman year if it wasn't for a guy named Boris Henderson, who, you know, was a teammate. You know, Boris grew up in more challenging circumstances, went to Geringer High School, was a part of communities and schools. I had a 2.2 GPA, a D+ in economics, but he was an All-American at the time and reached out to me and said, let's work together after practice. And I'm getting ready to say, this is just not for me. I'm a Florida kid. I got hair gel and gold chains. And, you know, I'm like, everyone's wearing button-ups. And I'm like, I've got a button-up on now, though, right? And I just remember that experience, though, because he engaged with me. And I think that's part of what we miss now. You know, I'm serving on the board as board chair. And I don't think I'd be in this community if it wasn't for him. Mm-hmm. And I think what we really miss, which is what I appreciate so much about how you all have defined, because the thing that really slows social capital down is segregation, mm-hmm, right? Especially in these bridging networks. But if Boris and I didn't have that relationship, like I thought I worked hard, but based on his upbringing, we were doing 4 sets of squats on paper. He said, no, we're going to do 10, mm-hmm, right? So I think what we could, I'm curious what you all, there's a quote from Desmond Tutu in the book No Future Without Forgiveness, and you know what he talks about with Ubuntu. I've probably said it in every episode, but the second part of this really struck me is that, you know, he says a person is a person through other persons. It is not I think therefore I am. It says rather I am human because I belong. I participate, I share. A person with Ubuntu is open and available of others, affirming of others, and does not feel threatened that others are able and good. And to see, you know, that when people are good, that we wanna put some fire on that, you know, right. and that this idea that I want you to be much better than me.
Right.
And I remember our first guest, Afuru, who then really was a huge social capital influence to me, you know, on the trip we were in D.C., and here she is, 17, a young black female. And at that age, I've been 10 years in facilitation. I've never met someone who has the skills she has, let alone the fact she's 17. Mm-hmm. And I just noticed in me this, well, I got to be the one to facilitate after the museum thing because, whoo, there's 18, you know, Brian Collier's here, the superintendent. I got to show. But what it was transformative to think what the group needed was her. Mm-hmm. And that was actually one of the most satisfying moments of my career, to think she just needed space. Mm-hmm. She needed room. She needed that chance, not for me to say you're great, but to feel potential. And I think as you all think about ways to inspire people with social capital, especially across communities and neighborhoods, here we are together here. And I feel like my journey knowing Brandon is just simply put becoming more human, mm-hmm, you know. And even recently when we were talking about travel and you said, it's good that you know other places, because, you know, as a black man, sometimes I'm thinking about where I can go and feel safe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm just not even thinking about that. And when you and POTUS, you know, being of Indian descent, told me you were thinking twice about going to the mountains because of what people were doing in the last couple of years. And I'm just like, I think that sometimes the default early response with people in my skin tone can be, oh gosh, I just don't deal with that. But what if we said, you know what? I'm going to not sacrifice. We're going to live in a community where we can create this together. We are each other. Mm-hmm. And we can really become more human. To hear a birthday song last night in Hindi. Mm-hmm. I mean, how beautiful is that? And that, but that's like, if you put four-year-olds in a room, that's how they like already understand it. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, as you know, there's so many, what are things that get people kind of inspired and thinking about this, or any other responses? I know I said a lot, so y'all got me excited.
Yeah, you said a lot. Because I think one of the things that's really difficult, so going back to that Brookings study, what we found is a lot of social capital, the place where people develop their social capital often, most often, is in an educational setting, school, either K-12 or, in many cases, college. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because of the segregation in Charlotte, it's very difficult. The schools are so highly segregated that it's very difficult to get that sort of natural, mixing people together. That would occur in a different community. So, you know, one of the interesting things is the same issues around mobility that exist in Charlotte exist in rural communities. Mm-hmm. All of the same issues. Right. But sometimes it might be easier in rural communities to work on these things because oftentimes, so for instance, I work in Richmond County a lot, which is an hour and a half east of here. There's only one high school. Mm-hmm. There's only one high school for the whole county. Sure. So, they're going to naturally get an opportunity. Here, we have highly segregated schools, so you have to be intentional. And if we think about the trip to D.C. that we took, that had to be manufactured because it doesn't exist ordinarily out in the wild. Yeah. So we have to be. And then if we think that even more levels of social capital get built in college setting. Well, then the pipeline for those low-income kids, and I'll just say this, one of the things that I think we make a huge mistake on is we tend to work with high-achieving, low-income students way too late. Like, we tend to focus on them in high school.
Agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe even not even ninth grade, like 10th, 11th. Mm-hmm. We got to make sure this kid gets over the barrier and gets to college. Yeah. We needed to work with that kid in elementary school to make them feel, and middle school, definitely. Middle school is where they're making real big decisions, life decisions. And so we focus too late, and to come back to your bigger point, one of the things that we've been looking at is like what would resonate with people to make them feel drawn to this work, because if you look at CAST, the book CAST, or all of these other things, that is a manufactured scarcity, that is a manufactured. I protect what I have because I live in fear that if I give a little away, someone else will overtake what I have. My child won't, all of these things. That is a manufactured, divisiveness.
Right.
So what if we were able to tap into like the spiritual, not religion necessarily, that's not what I'm saying, but the spiritual undertones of Desmond Tutu and others, which are the kind of things that I think flow through most people, which are the sense of I want to live in a world of abundance, not scarcity. Mm-hmm. I want to live in a world of mutual respect, not hatred. I want to live in a world of plenty where I have what I need and you have what you need, and so therefore I'm not burdened by that. You know, as I was driving over here, you see people in the. Across intersections, you look at that and you're like, oh man, I feel terrible. I just feel terrible. I'm not giving that person money.
Right.
Especially with children, it's even worse. Yeah, like you carry this weight around with you, even if you have affluence. So I think what we're trying to figure out is could you create a campaign, mm-hmm. a way of this community taking a step back and saying, I don't care what happens in D.C., I don't care what happens in Raleigh, here in Charlotte, this is who we are, mm-hmm. even if I wasn't born here. And therefore, we make decisions differently here based off of what I believe another person needs, that I'm willing to give a little. And by the way, because someone will say, well, you can't get everybody to agree to that. I don't need everybody.
That's right.
You know? First of all, I've already got a number of people who will agree with me. Yeah. And then I've got a number of people who will never agree. So, mm-hmm. and we spend all of our time and resources trying to change the mind of someone who's not. I get that malleable middle that people refer to mm-hmm. a lot. That's where you spend your time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes me think a lot about change and understanding the things that you mentioned are known resistances, right? Like there are these things that we know people are resistant about because they are afraid or they are fearing that they will lose out on something. And then even in change, right, there is a loss, right? There is this, when you change something, you are losing what you are comfortable with. You have to let that go mm-hmm. in order to make the next step. And so you kind of have to be a little bit uncomfortable in order to take that next step. But if we acknowledge that and we say, you know, we understand that this is different and you have to let go of something that might feel safe and might feel comfortable, but here are all these other things that will happen. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about being a catalyst, like you probably are not going to lose much, mm-hmm. right? You might gain or you might not shift any energy out of your own self, but you're going to propel all this additional energy into this next group of people.
Mm-hmm. And if someone said, well, give me an example of how that might work in the real world. I can give you a perfect example that the county is doing, which is moving towards universal access of childcare mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And universal pre-K. When you make things universal, it takes away, oh, that's what we do for poor people. Right. Oh, that, mm-hmm. Because we're all in this together.
Exactly.
And like I think about nurse visitations, mm-hmm. which my daughter was born in Guilford County, which had mandatory visitation for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I come from, now I'm a little more affluent than I was, white guy, and, you know, in some places you would think nurse visitation, especially some of the programs, are really only designed for low-income mm-hmm. Families. I was scared to death when the nurse came over. I wanted to make sure the car seat was mm-hmm. in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it was comforting when the nurse told you that you were doing a good job,
mm-hmm. right?
Or that just, hey, it's okay to be scared. And so when you make things universal, you remove the stigma that's attached to it and the sense of it only benefits one person.
Right.
I think the more you can move towards universality, the more you're like, you're addressing like the emotional aspect of this work. John Powell, who came here during the task force work, said, this idea of targeted universality. In other words, everybody, we set a community goal that's higher than where anyone else is achieving. So mm-hmm. literacy rates, right now, white girls achieve at the highest level. So set it even above where white girls achieve. But then looking at how do you do targeted interventions that are specific to the needs, and some get more, some might get a little less, but we're all in it together.
Everybody gets something.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because mm-hmm. it lifts every, you know, I love and he's the director of the Diversity and Belonging Institute at Cal Berkeley. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I love because he says that and I think that's what we miss in the argument is, for example, in social capital networks here. And this is what, you know, Obama did with My Brother's Keeper, is that it was targeted at Black boys, because we see this is the worst, the social capital is the worst for Black boys in this report, and that's what he found. But if you focus on that, it's actually going to rise all other marginalized groups, including those, quote, in the majority or at the level that we're trying to get to. And I think that's part of the other part of the survival is like, oh gosh, well, if we focus here, it's like, no, if we do, that will benefit everyone. So there is that kind of short-term, you know, we've talked about sacrifice of, and I think about it in public education of, you know, parents making decisions to send their kids across a community to learn, you know, you all going to Waddell. So Sahana learns, you know, Mandarin mm-hmm. and to be in a more multi-ethnic environment. there is that, all right, I got to drive, you know, 45 minutes, but what could that create? And how do we cultivate that, you know, kind of the common good in a society that day in and day out, we're, it's an individualized, in some way, society.
Well, it's an interesting point that just came to me right now. But, yeah, if you put in place the net,
yeah,
right, you're more likely to have people who are at the top that take leaps of faith. Mm-hmm. And you're more likely to, well, because now it's like, well, I see what happens at the very bottom, and I don't want my family to go there, even mm-hmm. if the most altruistic person's like, well, I don't want my kids mm-hmm. to be end up in that place. But if you realize there's a good safety net there for them, or mm-hmm. that if they don't make it, try risk, or whatever happens, they won't fall completely down to the bottom, then I think you'd be have more people willing to make the change. The other thing I'll say that Afuru, you mentioned Afuru, but she said something really that was insightful. It's like that I can't compete with you because I want you to succeed, and when you succeed, I succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think another aspect of this is that, like you said, when you let her go for it, and I've had it when I've done shared opportunities with people, it's so much more rewarding than if you were successful yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing someone else have that moment to be successful. And I think when people feel that, you start getting addicted to it. You're like, I got to find the next one.
Yeah.
So we can just share that somehow, the people to get that initial feeling. I think that would go a long way, too.
Mm.
You know, it's going back to your point about the safety net. So one of the things in the book I mentioned, Nordic Theory of Everything, she points out that because so much of American safety net things like healthcare and others are tied to your job,
yeah,
that think about the entrepreneur who is stuck at a company where he or she may not be the most productive there, or you know, if we had healthcare that was universally available and probably paid for, then that person might be more willing to take on an entrepreneurial role to go out and create the next, you name it, you know, major company. But here, you have to really be bold to take a step outside of a company, especially like a corporation.
That's right.
You know, I mean, with so much, trying to buy healthcare is a good example of, or you're scared because I need, my parents are aging, and man, I can't leave this job because they're relying upon me to make sure that they can stay in a facility, or that, you know, they have the care that they need. And then I got my kid, you know, all of these things that just create this system.
It's really hard.
Yeah, that's right.
So much going through my mind, especially as we talk about the home visits for new moms. I was there not that long ago. Didn't get a home visit. I don't know if I'm supposed to.
Yes.
But it
you
was
have
during,
a lovely new one,
on.
Right?
Yeah.
We're working on
Jocelyn.
It. Jocelyn. She'll be 9 months on Monday. And one of the things, I'm new to Charlotte, but one of the things I can for sure say that I have loved has been my healthcare. It has been, you know, really affirming when you talk about, like, having a new baby. My first baby, I was like, I don't really know what to do with this child, but I'm responsible. So, you know, and there are lots
That's how they feel about me. So.
Yeah. she's great. She's thriving. But I remember feeling so comforted in being in, like, a pressure cooker, right? When you first have a baby, the goal is to keep the baby alive.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel that innately and intensely.
Right.
And so knowing that there are other people there to support you brings you that comfort. And I liken that too, as we think about how we want to create spaces for abundance, we tend to focus on the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And our team talks a lot about what does it mean to ask better questions?
Mm-hmm.
And in that, getting better around the how. Like, we focus so much on, like, what are we trying to accomplish? When are we going to get it done? How we know, well, you know, how we know if we've gotten there? But we don't talk a lot about how are we moving together and what do we want that to look like. And one thing for sure that I know the task force and Brian got right well before me is being sure that the council was 50-50 or 50-51, community and corporate. And that if we were going to do community work, everyone needed to be at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so not just there in name, but also extending ourselves and saying, well, how do you work? And how can we think about that differently?
Mm-hmm.
How can we come together to have a solution if it comes back to the quote or proverb around going further together?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I think as much as we talk about where we want to be, what it looks like to be in community is necessary. I had a boss when I worked in education who always talked about pressure and support and how you have to have it in equal amount. So as much as we are calling someone forward or asking them to do more, like you talked about being in a new space.
Right.
What extra support are we giving them to get there?
That's
right. Keep the expectation high and also increase the support you're giving them to hit that mark. So I think that's also just important to think about as we talk about being in community with one another and extending grace, really, as we all try to figure it out together.
Man, I love the pressure and support. That's good parenting advice, too. That's good.
Taking notes.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking a little bit about what you're saying, and kind of we talk a lot in theory. So even in healthcare, right, we talk about theories, we do research, people evaluate things and study things and write things up. But these guys know I'm very much action oriented. So like, at what point do you then take the step and say like, let's try something? It might not be the best answer, but like, we need to take all this information that we know and not just sit on it and, you know, write it up a little bit more and study even deeper, because at some point we got to move.
Yeah.
So at what point does, you know, your two institutions or our community and our county really think, okay, it's time, let's make some actions, let's test some things out?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're there. And I can thankfully say that Charlotte has been there for a while. When I came on board, you know, one thing that became really clear to me is that Charlotte is a very giving community, and giving in terms of resources, in terms of time, and wanting the community to be better. And so after the task force, you know, folks took off running. Whether it be corporate organizations, government organizations, nonprofits, all shifted their language towards economic mobility and their strategies in that direction, and have made tremendous progress, as Brian noted, around universal pre-K, affordable housing. Lots of work has been done towards workforce development. And now where we find ourselves about 5 years in is that we've learned. Right. And so now we need to be smarter around how we're working together. And part of us being smarter in that work is really authentically bringing in issues around social capital and segregation into the problem. Again, I think what my team is uncovering is that folks are ready to tackle the issue, but we also need the right skills and combination of people to solve something that we know is generational, cannot be solved with one single organization or one single person, and we need to come together to do it. So I didn't say that to say that, like, we're ready now, and it's just as much as we have a vision for what the future needs to look like, what Leading on Opportunity is looking to do is to bring the knowledge and the skills to facilitate that change.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And I think the one thing that we have not done very well, to be very candid, is we haven't really communicated that a lot of the things that have happened over the last 4.5 years since March of 2017 were the result of the task force report.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of things were happening, but we failed kind of to tie them all together to show people that, hey, on page this, you know, page X in the report, it says move from $25 million to $50 million every other year for the city bonds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Done twice now, by the way, mm-hmm. two referendums.
Yeah.
That the private sector should match that amount of money. Done, check off. That we should move towards universal access for all 4-year-olds and then move down. Done, the county has moved. The city has aligned their budget. The county has aligned their budget. Churches have responded. So we haven't, it pains me whenever people tell me nothing's happened. Two points to that. One, we haven't communicated well. The other is, like, there's this belief that we've been talking about this since 2014. No, it's not true. Nobody was talking about this other than our little task force and a few other people until Keith Lamont Scott lost his life.
Yeah, right.
Then all of a sudden it was like, this is the most important work ever and we got to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I have a newspaper article that I can show people that where the Observer was criticizing this work, mm-hmm. saying it's going to be pointless and worthless. Before the report came out. And so, you know, part of it is, hey, let's face the urban myth that we were all in this together and we all mutually recognize that we were 50th of 50. And then secondly, let's also recognize what we have done.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where you go in the country right now, if people who are knowledgeable on this topic, they will tell you Charlotte's got something interesting
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter where you go in this community, for the most part, people use the words upward mobility or economic opportunity. They use some phraseology that recognizes that there is a common language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, definitions are different.
Mm.
The
mm-hmm.
the work that Sherry's got to do is to remind people that it's systems, not programs.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
It's not one thing. It's all
things.
Things.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good testament or a reminder to celebrate our victories too, though, right?
Which we don't do. We people love to move here and rip the city down. You know,
Yeah. And I think we, you know, like that clearly is not gonna, you know, I heard someone describe this really well. He's a great policy activist in here, and I think sometimes we get caught. You know, Sherry, you and I had this discussion about when we were talking about, you know, a great leader we both respect in Denise Watts, and mm-hmm. why was she such a person who could mm-hmm. galvanize? And because she created tension. Mm. And, you know, what this policy activist has shared is like, I need people protesting. I need the activism because they want to activate, because when something happens, I can swoop in and get the policy passed, mm. right? And I also need corporate. We said we need creative. And I feel like if we continue to do more as a community to just say we need each other, we need our different perspectives, we don't have to take sides as much. And I think sometimes in Charlotte we get caught in who's doing it right and how is this versus like let's hold the tension. Let's maybe take a bias towards people in community, people with the lived experience to really inform. Mm-hmm. And that we all have responsibility. And so we have a little gift for you all here. This is probably one of our favorite kids' books called mm-hmm. One. And it reconnected me. It's an author named Catherine Atoshi. I hope I said that correctly. I haven't met her before. But it's one of my favorite books because anytime I get where, especially you all in systems work, mm-hmm. where it can feel so big, is, you know, the moral of this story is it just takes one. It just takes one person. So I think for me, as we close out.
So, John, if I could just say, because you mentioned Denise Watts. Denise tells a story. So think of how powerful a voice she is and has become and now has moved off to Houston. But she tells a story when I was talking about social capital to her one day. She was literally walking the halls. I think she grew up in like Fayetteville or someplace like that. No college plans. And then a person, senior year, and then a guidance counselor or a teacher or someone walked by and said, you know, what are your plans? Well, I have none. You need to go to college. Mm-hmm. And so that person, like, there's Denise would have been lost to the world, maybe, if that one person hadn't spotted her and told her that she was special. So it all comes around.
The one person, so right? It does. And to think that what you say, the conversations we have. So I'd love to hear as we close out, you know, y'all are going to be doing some great work, Sherry and Brian. And how can people plug in? How can they support you? And then in closing thoughts, we'd love to hear, because this work, there's a lot. What gives you hope? What has you maintained hope for the change?
So as we move forward, we will be very intentional about bringing in community voice. Mm-hmm. And so I ask that people look for that. One of the things that we will be doing is being more intentional about how we're using our media outlets. So folks can definitely find us at Leading on Opportunity everywhere. Mm. Connect to us there through our policy person, Tanya Jameson, who most folks know in the grassroots community. She'll be helping us be intentional about our work. So we ask for your voice and perspective as we lean further into that. And in particular, as Brian has already mentioned, because so much richness comes from the college experience, we'll be focusing our efforts on college and career readiness. So what does it look like to make that experience full for everyone? So that'll be a really key point. In terms of what gives me hope, honestly, y'all give me hope in this. When I look to folks who are not like directly connected to the work, but have also been able to grab hold of it and make it theirs, and bring people into it in a different way, is very encouraging. As Brian said, we're thinking about what does it look like to build on our ability to create a shared language, right? People know economic mobility, but then how do we move beyond that into abundance, to use your language? Yeah. And folks like y'all are doing that. And so as we are sometimes in our little bubble trying to figure it out, it feels good to know that others are also pushing forward. And then that means we're in community doing it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's all perfect. And one of the things I like to, again, go back to the report and highlight, because a lot of this is there. We just have to go and read it line by line, like I have many, many times, literally line by line when we were writing it. Is a section that we said, what would it look like if before every major decision was made in this community, we stopped and asked ourselves a question about how does this decision impact the economic trajectory of our children and their caregivers. And what we try to then say is, like, as a faith community, you would potentially look at it like this, with humility, you know, not just go volunteer and do something that is toxic charity, but instead candidly think through. As a corporate community, think about your hiring policies, not just your volunteering and your donations, but also what are your internal policies. So think about all of these things. But, I mean, often, as Sherry said, it starts with you, starts with this group, starts with a person making a decision about whether they'll go advocate for, if there's a school reassignment question, if there's a zoning issue, as we know. So it often just starts with a person, and hopefully that builds from there. And as far as what gives me hope, Sherry's team, having Sherry on board, having the perspective of someone like her professionally, but also your whole perspective changes when you have your own child, and now you start to see, believe me, as a father of a 17-year-old, you know, it's a constant battle, and you want them to grow up in a world that's better than the one that you inherited. So that it becomes personal. But I just, this place gives me hope in terms of Charlotte. I mean, I think that there's goodwill. I think there's a lot that can be kind of, you can despair at times, but that's not a good place for any of us, because there's too many people, too many kids. I just came from a program for immigrants and refugee children. They're depending upon us.
There's so many thoughts that I have run through my head, too, that I just want to ask you guys about, so we might have to have you back. I want to ask you about nonprofits and toxic philanthropy, but I think what stands out to me is just thinking about, how did I get to where I am, and what did it take, and how can I pass that along to someone else, and appreciating at first that it's not all me. I'm a millennial, so I think I'm special, as apparently we all do.
Hey, you're very special.
Thank you.
Yes, very special. But you got to say it twice.
But I do think it's appreciating that, and so I will take that away, and I've just been thinking about that, but... Thank you all for being here. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I would say cheers to the Melissas and the Mary Claires and the folks that lifted all of us up along our way and our journey. And I hope that there is more and more of that as we move forward.
Yeah, it's just that I'm struck again. In that book, there's a line before that everyone counts, and that part of the story is also about forgiveness and reconciliation. And I think those are key parts to the abundance conversation, is that the more we can reconcile in ourselves and in communities and then start anew and start creating, it's going to create enthusiasm and excitement. So our whole team, we are so grateful for you having moved here, for the work that you're embarking on, for the team that you've built, knowing who you have involved with Tanya and Virginia, and there's another
AJ
and Nandy. Nandy. Mm-hmm. Just amazing. And Brian, you know, you continue to push us by attracting national experts, and I think that's the other thing that we forget about having a very successful large foundation, is people don't realize that people at Harvard and DC and Brookings, and yes, those are big names, but they bring thinking and resources to accelerate what we do. So thank you for continuing to be a thought leader in moving this work.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, John, for bringing us together. We didn't tell our story, but I will really quickly. A friend of mine who I went to graduate school with at Harvard,
that's right,
lives here, saw that I moved and was like, I know someone you should meet. And I was like, okay, but I'm about to have this baby, so I'll meet him when I have that. And so I reach out to John and I said, John, it goes one way. And I say, John, I'd love to meet you, but I'm going to have a baby and I'll come back. And I came back and I said, would you like to meet? And he was like, sure. And so we meet for coffee in my workout clothes. And I think immediately John was like, I like her.
I think I had my dog too.
He had his dog Larry with him. And we had an instant connection as someone who I could clearly see had a heart for this work and really just people. Yeah. And so thank you, John, for, you know, being a catalyst and bringing us all together.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all.
We invite you to continue making room with us. You'll find this episode and all of our exciting and meaningful conversations on Apple, Spotify, or really anywhere you choose to listen to podcasts.
Join the Making Room movement and get more info at makingroomwithus.com, or follow us on Instagram at Making Room With Us.
Thank you for showing up for us and each other. Until next time.
You are wonderful and full of truth. Just as you are.
Just as you are.
You are wonderful, so full of truth. Full of truth, just as you are, just as you are, you're welcome here just as you are.